If you traveled into the South African township of Soweto back in the 1970s, you had a good chance of walking into a cloud of tear gas. One of the most violent uprisings was in June of 76, when the military of the apartheid government opened fire on a march of school children. Hundreds of people died, all of them black. In that same year, Vincent Mansway was 5 years old. Now, the clashes were all around his home, but his mother kept him hidden under a bed. Even so, the family kept to its tradition of early morning drumming. And that was the start of Mansway's artistic career. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Vincent Mansway's grandmother and his aunties and his mother were all sangomas, traditional healers. Vincent was told that while he was still in the womb, he kicked and moved around so much, his mother and grandmother both concluded, "This one will be a dancer." A truer prediction was probably never made. Vincent is now a world-renowned choreographer. I caught up with him while he was in the States on tour with the dance Menjaro. We talked about his childhood in a poor but somewhat enchanted home in Soweto.
It was 4 rooms, 2 bedrooms, a toilet, and a kitchen and the living room. Very tiny, very, very tiny. For how many people will be like at least 30 people in that house? But what was very important is that every morning, my grandmother, my auntie, my mother, they'll wake up and they'll make us to be up as well, to play the drum, like 4 o'clock in the morning, every day. That was important.
4 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, 4 o'clock in the morning, every single morning, you know, every day. We'll play the drum for 1 hour before everybody could even, like, you know, take a bath and prepare themselves because, you know, everything was so far.
Now, was this to learn the drum as a musical instrument or to learn the drum as an instrument for the healing?
It's to learn the instrument as a healing process, you know, and just to greet the day. You know, you greet the day before even the cock will
so
like,
playing
you know,
the drum like praying, really?
Yeah, it's like praying, you know. We communicate with our ancestors, you know. We're asking for, of course, for protection and to ask for guidance, to ask for, you know, it's the same like when we're going to change. It's the same thing, but then we do it very, very differently. For me, it was very, very important to do that. And my peers having to be in the streets when I played with them, they knew. My family, it was a family of shamans and family of people who were very spirited. And yet at the same time, you know, they were very scared of me.
So would they say, "Let's go get Vincent, we're going to play football"? Or, "No, no, we can't get him now because there's a ceremony at the house."
No. I mean, they wouldn't get me when I'm supposed to be. I mean, if it was time for ceremony, they would never disturb me. I have to be home. But then when it's time to go and play, I will go and play. It was a very interesting process.
Let me ask you something,
person.
Though. I've read of the sangomas that at some point in the way that they communicate with their ancestors, mm-hmm. the shaman will actually go into a trance. Just
That's correct.
And mm-hmm. not be the person that they were. I wonder what it was like for you as a small boy the first time you saw your mother go into a trance. I mean, I was imagining that and thinking it might be quite frightening.
Frightening. And I was in tears every day. And I couldn't understand why she was in pain. And she usually was not in pain. I mean, they were not in pain. It was just the emotions. It's just the different life form that they were trying to live, trying to portray. And this one, I think I do remember because she still tells me even today that I literally even went to drag a dress, you know, while she was in trance.
To pull her away.
I pulled her away. I said, "What's happening? Are you dying? Are you dying? What's wrong? What's wrong?" You know, and for her, you know, she couldn't even hear me. She couldn't even feel me because
she was somewhere else.
Yeah. Obviously, my grandmother, she had to pull me away and to explain things. It's okay, you know, it's life, it's like this. But it was a very frightening process. I mean, an experience for a young person to see something like that is really disturbing and you don't understand exactly what's happening. The energy, the force, you know, the force of their spirits is absolutely, you know.
It can be quite violent.
Very violent, depending on what kind of an ancestor comes into your body.
You know, I'm listening to you describe this and I've seen you dance and I'm thinking to myself, you were watching this kind of out-of-body experience.
Yeah.
From a very, very small age.
It is something that, you know, you have been taught as a young person. You know, it's something that you learn. Obviously, you have to have a very good eye to observe exactly what's happening. When they finish getting out of the trance, they don't know what happened. And then I have to relay, as a person watching, I have to relay exactly what they said. and you write it through the spiritual of movement and how you change or when they go to trance, how they actually become somebody else.
But you also have to be a really good reporter.
Oh,
to
yes.
To know what happened. To be able to reproduce it another time and then to build on that. Right?
Exactly. Because, you know, it's quite very important. I mean, the information that, you know, we receive is very, very important. And at one point, when there was a ceremony home, there was about maybe 15 Sangomas. And this man went to trance, and the spirit said to him, look, you have to go and get this kind of a goat somewhere, and then you must go now.
Get the goat?
Yeah, go and get the goat. This goat is in this kind of a place, and the color is like this. It's got how many spots? Go and get it now. And that man just stormed. He was still in trance. He just stomped. He moved. He came back with the goat holding the horns. He came with the goat and, you know, rather than there. And the same thing that they told him to get, it was there. It's this kind of thing that, you know, sometimes you wonder, how is it possible that, you know, the people who passed on a long time ago, they will know all these things. And then they will tell you exactly where to get it.
And all the time that you were watching this, and as a young boy, were you ever questioning it? Were you ever going, I wonder if the ancestors are real? Or did you know that you were very small that this was a real kind of communication across generations?
No, I didn't question anything in this particular time. You know, you were not allowed to question. All you have to do is just observe and experience and be part of whatever it is what's happening. And even today, you know, I don't believe that, you know, I would have questioned that because I truly believe in it.
You would play drums as a small child. Now, would you also play this drum as a part of the ceremony?
Yes, I'll play the drum with the sticks. Usually we play with the sticks from 6 o'clock in the evening until 4 o'clock in the morning the next day.
Wow.
So it's like nonstop. And then it's a tea time, 6 o'clock in the morning.
Or sleep time.
You are not allowed to sleep for 3 days. When we have a ceremony, it's always 3 days. No sleeping.
Wow.
You can't sleep. Well, you can sleep on Sunday, you know, after lunch, or Sunday after lunch. You can sleep.
A day of rest.
You can sleep. Especially Friday, because Fridays is very, very important. It's only the family. Because there are things that, you know, either maybe if the husband of whoever is not behaving very well, and they will tell very big secret stuff, you know.
Better that we not have that broadcast all over the neighborhood, right?
Yeah. So, you know, and that is very important, which goes until like the next day. And the next day, that's when other Sangomas, they come. And it's just magic, you know. It's just different colors of clothing, and it's just magic.
So exciting for someone like you to watch.
You know, and the drum. You know, the drum is a very important task.
You have a drum with you. Can you give us just an idea of what the kind of drumming you would do at that time?
Well, we have two basic rhythms that we usually play. One comes from either the Zulu people or the Xhosa people. And what we play basically is we play a drum called isigubu. Unfortunately, this is not isigubu, but it's the West African drum called the Jujumba, the one I have now. And this drum is connected because it comes from a skin of a cow. And every time when you play that drum, depending on the speed that you're playing in, it means that, you know, you're controlling the dancers. You control the energy of how much they can go and then how much, you know, so that they can go to trance. It's connected to their heartbeat because it's got a very deep do-do, do-do. So this is, obviously, you know, this drum is not designed for that. But then the one that I'm talking about is massive, it's big. And it's got a very deep gudu, gudu.
Like a heartbeat.
Like a heartbeat. Yeah. So it's connected to your heartbeat. You know, when you play faster, the heart goes faster. That's when you start to go to trance. Your blood starts to pump very, very strong. And the other
So who's in charge here, Vincent? If you have the drummer who's controlling the speed of the drumming and therefore controlling the dance, is it the drummer who's the conductor of the...
No, the basic person who controls the rhythm and the speed is the Sangoma. You have to be able to adjust or adapt to what they're doing.
So if your mother was dancing and you were playing, you're watching her and your drum beat keeps pace with what she's doing.
But then when she starts to go into trance, then I'm in control. I have to speed up. And then another rhythm which changes everything, which is this one.
Much more driving.
More driving, you know. So, it's, and then this rhythm is basically for the Shangani people, one of the tribe people in South Africa. So, you know, you have just two basic rhythms, you know, that we use compared to, you know, when you go to West Africa. Because South Africa is not necessarily a drumming country. It's more of a singing country. You know, we use the voice more rather than the drum.
So would you do just the drumming, or would you also do some of the
singing.
Dancing? And singing? No,
yeah, and singing as well. Yeah. You have to sing. You not just play and, you know, just use your hands. You have to sing as well.
And so it's lyrics that you're singing?
Yeah, lyrics.
That would sound like what? Give me an example.
Hambyo la la mgoma, hambyo la la mgoma, hambyo la la mgoma, hambyo la 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 mgoma. And this song is basically a song of my mother. It's a song for her to rest after the trance. Huh. And she sings that song every time when she finished her going to trance. So, you know, every Sangoma's got her own song or his song to finish everything. So, you know, it's really very important. You have to sing. You have to sing. You can't just be, you know, even when you're just a spectator, you can't just sit. You have to clap, you know. Keep on clapping, keep on singing. It's part of it. You know, you become part of that.
I get the feeling that it would be kind of hard not to participate.
Oh, no. It's impossible. It's really impossible.
Wait a minute. That's Billie Jean. Michael Jackson? We will talk about what this music has in common with this South African choreographer, Vincent Mansue, in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Vincent Mansue is a choreographer from South Africa. I spoke with him the last time he was in the U.S. on tour with his dance Menjaro. That translates to We Are All Friends. Funny thing is, he had no training in dance as a child.
I began professional dancing at the age of 20.
That's old for a dancer to start, that kind of discipline dancing.
That's very difficult. You know, that's very, very old and very difficult. But then the more difficult part was within the community, because they truly believed that, you know, If you were doing something out of the norm, something that is out of the tradition, something is wrong with you.
Oh, don't take this dance and put it on a stage somewhere in Cape Town for customer. Is that what they were saying?
No, well, even if you were doing like contemporary dance, they would be like, "What are you doing? Say it again. What? And the worst part of it was that because we were still in this process of democracy, the apartheid, and the guys, the boys that I was dancing with, they will say, you have to be part of the toy-toying. You have to be, you know.
The toy-toy is the stomping dance that we remember
You have to
protests.
Be a comrade, a very strong comrade. You have to go and fight, you know. For me personally, I was not there. I was not in that kind of direction, you know, and because I found something that, you know, I was very comfortable and I felt more alive doing, which was dancing.
Were there people saying to you at the time that contemporary dance was not masculine enough?
No, I mean, I was called names. I was called a sissy boy. I was called gay.
Did this bother you at the time? Or
no,
it
didn't. It really didn't. And I had one cousin who was bothered by the fact that, you know, I was going to dance. So, you know, so it was very difficult. So I had obviously arguments with not my ladies, you know, the cousins, the women, because I was brought up by women most of the time. But then with the boys, you know, we were always fighting, you know. Yes, you must go and fight. You must go and do this. You must go and crush a cow, someone. I said, but what's the point? You know, what is the point really? What am I going to gain? Yeah, you're going to gain, you know, the respect. I said, well, For me, it doesn't work like that, really. You know, I'd rather do something that people will respect me in a different way, do something that is, you know, is valuable to the people. At some point, I did, you know, go to a toy and running after cars and chased by the police.
But there are other things that are going on in your life, and I want to just hear a little bit of the music that was also a part of your life and everyone else's life from that time.
Oh, yeah.
You recognize what we're playing.
Yeah, that would be Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson, Billie Jean, that was Moonwalking.
Yeah,
from the early 80s.
That's correct, yes.
And you were seeing that at the same time as it was being seen everywhere else in the world?
You know, I mean, in South Africa, I mean, I suppose it would be the same thing now, you know, especially when you go to the rest of Africa, when people were talking about, like, the modern dance. And for me, and some of my dancers, like the people that were in the same community, like, you know, what we call, because I had a small youth club called the Joy Dancers. And we will be doing this kind of a copycat of Michael Jackson at this time. And this was like, you know, we had like, you know, black and white small TV. So, and then we'll go to someone's house, and then sometimes they will not even allow us to get in. So they will open the curtain just to watch outside from the window. And we'll be watching all, like, you know, the dancing, and then Fame came in. Fame, I'm gonna, you know. And for us, it was like magic. It was like, I want to do that. I really want to do that. But the most topping one was Michael Jackson, you know, because we were really fascinated about how this man can move. And besides, you know, having to do our own traditional, our traditional was more complicated. But then we were seeing him very differently.
You know, were you trying to sort of mix all this together at this point? Or?
Well, not really mixing, but then trying to copycat, you know, and it was not really possible to be like him.
You did learn to moonwalk, though, didn't you?
Oh, yes. and breakdancing. And breakdancing.
Fame was still a long way off for Vincent Mansue. He and a few of his friends from the Joy Dancers Youth Club in Soweto thought they'd take a chance on dancing professionally. It came to them almost as a lottery.
One of my friends, he spotted an advert from this newspaper saying that, you know, Schweppes, you know,
the soda.
Schweppes is announcing that, you know, is giving 1 year scholarships for underprivileged black kids to go and study in this company called Moving Into Dance in Town. And we were like, oh, yes, in town. Yes, we're going.
This was in Johannesburg.
In Johannesburg. And we didn't know, you know, what will be the results of that. And because we were still you, because for us, you put music, you dance. That's it. You know, there's no question about, you know, what you're doing, and no question. And we went to the auditions.
How old were you at this time?
I was 20 years.
Okay.
I was 20 years. I'll say 19 and a half.
Yeah.
19 and a half. And we went to the auditions, which ran for, like, you know, 3 weekends. And when we arrived, you know, it was a mixed group of people. And I said to my friend, I was wearing, like, I didn't have any dance clothes. It's just my...
No leg warmers, no tights. No.
That was foreign for me. That was way foreign
for
me.
So what were you wearing?
I was just wearing my normal clothes.
Pair of black pants?
Yeah. And I had the Brentwood, the pants. Brentwood, I remember. And I had a nice shirt for Sunday, going to church. And very nice polished shoes.
You were dressed up. You were going to an audition.
Yeah.
Not dancing clothes, though.
And, you know, for the first time, we've seen people limbering and stretching and doing things and pirouettes. And I said to my friend, are we in the right place? I'm sure we are in the wrong place. So it became a joke, you know, because we didn't know. And we looked very awkward, really, really bizarre. And things, the movements, the contemporary movements for us were like, wait a minute, this is not what we signed for. You know, this is totally out of our normal things.
So you're not dressed like the other dancers. You're not stretching.
We're not stretching. Like we're just waiting, you know. Okay, next. Do it.
What was the music that you played? Do you remember?
The woman who was auditioning there, Beth LG, she was one of my mentors. She put on Barbara Streisand. Barbara Streisand.
Which one?
I'm a woman in love.
And wanted you to dance to that, like you've been dancing to this music.
I'm a woman in love. And the other one was cross line music. The doo-doom, doom, the George Benson, I think.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Doo-doom, the cross line. And so that's what I said, oh, wait a minute, this is not working for us, you know. We are not used to this. And the worst part is that they want to see the bodies, and we were not used to being getting naked anyhow, you know.
So did they say, take your shirt off, we want to see you dance?
Yeah, they take your shirt off and shoes off, you know, it's okay. For the shoes, it's fine because I will be dancing in a bare feet anyway. It's fine. Yeah. But the whole thing was very, you know, strange. And obviously, we got in and...
So you got your one-year scholarship.
So I got, me and my friend, we got one-year scholarship where we were trained in different techniques and styles. And part of it was, you know, to be able to write English and learn English because we couldn't speak English at that time. We did that, you know, for a whole year. And at the end of the scholarship, obviously, you know, we got our diplomas and they asked us to come back the next year because when it was finished. So Schweppes came in again saying, oh, I think there's a lot of improvement. There's a lot of, potential here. We'll extend the scholarship for another year. So we stayed for another year. And the third year, that's when they asked us to be in a company. And we just worked very hard. You know, we really worked very hard to be.
Now, there were friends of yours in Soweto who were pretty suspicious about this move into modern dance. At some point in this first year or the second year, were you able to persuade your father or your cousin that what you were doing was an interesting and valuable profession?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, in a township, obviously, there were people who were very declining. They were not happy with the fact that, you know, I was training in town. I mean, for me, it was a big deal.
Was their objection, though?
Well, you know, why shouldn't I be training in a township? Because people were scared to come in a township. I mean, the white people were very scared. You know, it was not possible. But at the same time, you know, it was even more scarier for a black man to go to Johannesburg, to the city, because, you know, you'll be asked, you know, where is your ID and things like that. But the mere fact that, you know, I had to really convince my father, he really wanted me to be a football player. For him, soccer was the number one. There were no other options, you know, go and play soccer. And he didn't really not approve.
What was the point when your father thought, okay, maybe he's not going to be a football player, but his name will be up in lights anyway.
It's when I went to Spain for the Well Expo in 1992. That was my second year in the school, and I said to him, you know, I'm going to go to Spain. I'm going to Europe. He says, "Are you lying? You're lying. You're just saying that. You know, are you lying?" I said, "Okay, you'll see in 1 month." And he didn't believe it. He really didn't believe it. And I, you know, we went to Europe and then we came back. And I brought some souvenirs and, you know, the photos. He was in tears. That was like a turning point for him. It was a turning point. But the real turning point was when I got my first award. The same year, I got my first solo. And that's when he said, my boy, he saw me in newspapers. He says, my boy is famous. You know, and for him, you know, and every time when he comes to his performance, he's crying. He's still crying even today, you know, because he cannot believe that, you know, how I've shaped my life and how I've managed to really hold myself, you know, to be a person who inspire other people, especially from my own community. I mean, because a lot of people in South Africa, they really respect my work and they respect who I am. And like this for him is a credit.
My guest is Vincent Mansue, the South African choreographer. You're listening to The Story from American Public Media. I'm Dick Gordon. I went to see Vincent perform, and one thing struck me. So often dancers hold their faces almost expressionless. I assume that it makes those of us in the audience concentrate on the shape and the movement of their whole body. When Vincent dances, there's so much expression in his face you can't look away. He says that came from Indonesia.
I learned Balinese dance when I was in Australia.
Which can be very expressive.
Yeah, very expressive. And, you know, I learned martial arts. I learned Tai Chi and, you know, and all these things. And
these are a lot of very disciplined.
Very disciplined.
Things to add to your dance. And
definitely.
If I understand what you're saying, the dance prior to this was a much more sort of free from deep inside.
More definitely, yes.
So is it hard to bring that all together?
It was. It was a very hard work, you know, but because of the belief that I had and the trust that, you know, I really want to do this, my focus was based on the fact that, you know, I really wanted to bring these energies together, these different techniques, these disciplines together, you know, because it is possible. Only if, you know, a person who's doing it is able to have that kind of respect and the freedom to express it in a way that, you know, whoever is watching is able to say, to breathe, you know, within, I mean, I don't know, it's something very special.
It's like you're watching it and saying something important is happening here. I may not understand what it is,
something important, exactly, something important is happening. But then what it is, I don't understand it. But at least I am able to feel the energy of this person. I'm able to be transported in a different world, and I'm able to understand much more better of who I am. I mean, I'm very fortunate. And even today that, you know, when I go home, I still have to, you know, ask for permission. I have to, you know, to give thanks, to say, you know, thank you, you know, and you're giving me this task. Because people know that I'm a traditionalist, especially in South Africa. They know that. Even when I go to some of the traditional people, they know that, you know, this is what I stand for. And what I do is a benefit for them.
In fact, your new piece, Menjaro, is done primarily with African traditional
instruments.
You've got kudu horn and the marimba, the bow harp. Anthony Kaplan is the composer.
That's correct.
It's important for you to have those traditional instruments,
Yes. Because I really felt that, you know, for some reason, there is a lot of not known instruments from South Africa, or even they're getting lost, for that matter, or not even played anymore. So for me, you know, I was really keen in bringing these instruments to a wider audience. Because in most cases, when you're talking about traditional music or instruments, people will tell you about West African instruments, like a djembe, dudumba, kora. You know, they will tell you about that. But then if you're talking about South African music, people will tell you, oh, yes, Miriam Makeba. Oh, yes, Huma Sekela. Oh, Black Mambazo. You know, yes. But then what about the indigenous instruments? Because, you know, we have wonderful indigenous instruments that, you know, people play. You know, we have Omuhube, Ohadi. We have...
Translation, what are these?
Ohadi is a bow instrument. It looks like a berimbo, both Ohadi and Muhube. They look like a berimbo, but very differently played. And it's only a women instrument. It's only played by women. Only one string with a stick. That's it.
That's it?
That's a Ohadi.
Describe what it looks like.
It's got a small calabash attached to it. It's got a nice small calabash attached to a long stick, and then, behind that is a bow. And then when the women, they play this instrument, basically is that, you know, they play it against their breast, so they can make a different sound when
by
they play.
Holding it tighter.
They move it when they play, and they move it, you know, to get different melodies and different whatever, I don't know what they call it. Yeah.
I'll be back with Vincent Mansway in just a moment. We'll talk some more about the indigenous music that he uses in his choreography, and we'll hear some. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. This music is from the dance piece Menjaro. My guest is Vincent Mansue, a choreographer who takes different influences from around the world, but always places them in a South African context, with African music. In this case, he's dancing a wild solo, drawn on what he heard in his own home with his mother, and that includes the ululating.
This is mostly, you know, to do with dancing this dance of the sangomas, but then stretching it more further, you know, challenging my body much more deeper. And the ululating, the woman who's ululating is very, very important, you know. And the ululating is basically to say that we are here and we are introducing ourselves.
Well, it's not an expression of sadness or joy.
Oh, no. I mean, it's in between. It's in between, depending, you know, what happens in within the dance itself. And because that what happens within the dance is that, you know, I start quite very, you know, obviously vigorously, but then very, you know, enjoying myself. But then it goes more deeper towards, the, you know, the middle of the dance, going more into more serious, more. It's more challenging to the audience, you know, in that way. And that's when, you know, I go to a state of trance.
And this will happen even in performance.
Oh, yes. No, yeah. It'll happen. It'll happen.
Does that it trouble you at all? Like, I mean, could you lose something when you're in trance?
No. Never. Because I've learned to control my body in a way that, you know, there's something that, you know, my grandmother and my mother told me and taught me that you have to separate your body into two worlds. One part of your body has to be within the performance level, and one part is has to be with the spirit world.
So the other performers who are dancing with you, they don't look over and they don't go, uh-oh, Vincent's in a trance. Where are we going now?
No, they know.
They know where you're going to be.
Now they know. Even the musicians, now they know exactly. In the beginning, they were nervous. They were like, this is not possible. We cannot really handle this.
This is high-risk dancing, yeah.
But now they know. And same thing, some of the dancers, they outside of the stage, like in the wings, they're waiting, they're riding the wings, they talk to me, you know, and the musicians, they talk to me as well. When I'm done, they talk to me and try to bring me back. So it's really about this communication that I'm trying to portray. And sometimes, obviously, you cannot see, you know, what's behind the scene of the when they're in the wings. They talk to me, you know, it's like this communication, constant talking to each other, constant looking at each other, what we're doing and what we're saying when we're delivering the movements. And my part is really kind of like the climax of the whole process, because after that, that's when we go into a group finale, and just to, you know, rev up, if I may say so, rev up everything a little bit more higher. And you know, the state of trance, you know, it's very important. And you mentioned something that, you know, obviously my face changes, you know, the expression of my movements becomes much more deeper, you know, other than just, okay, I'm just, you know, delivering my hand in this position. But then it's something, you know, I don't control. I'm not controlling my arm to be in this position. It goes naturally. So things becomes much more deeper. You know, even though, yes, I am still doing the same movement, but then it's something totally different now.
And are you singing at this point as well?
No, I'm not singing. It's only two people singing. But what happens is that, you know, I say things on stage. I say things on stage because I'm talking to people. I'm talking to whoever is with me on stage.
So I have a question for you about this, because if, and you'll correct me if I get this wrong, but the whole shaman, sangom thing, it's very serious. You're speaking directly to ancestors. You don't mess around with this, right?
No.
Is there any risk that when you mix in all those influences that come from dance forms from all over the world, everything from Bali to Michael Jackson, that some ancestor's going to go, no, you're messing around with this. We don't, you know, go back to the way things are meant to be.
Well, you know, it's because things that I do, they're very authentic, you know, they're very organic. And for the mere fact that, you know, I'm allowed to do it, you know, it's the permission that they're giving me to do it. It's for a reason that, you know, because I'm not a sangoma or a shaman that uses medicine, you know, the herbs and things, but I'm a different sangoma on stage.
But you are a sangoma. This is something that you inherit, right?
Yeah.
Do you have a role as a healer, as a sangoma? Is the dance that you do on stage, Is it more than entertainment?
No, it's more than entertainment. You know, it's education. You know, education of how things are possible. You know, education of the preservation of culture, but then having to be able to move within the 21st century time. And this education, you know, is an important one about culture. It's about a human being. You know, it's about who you are, where you come from, and what does your spirit tells you? Because everybody's got a spirit. So for me to be able to do this is I try to find a way to connect all these different cultures, because somewhere, somehow, we have something in common. Somewhere, somehow. You know, excluding the color of a human skin, you know, we have a connection. We all come somewhere. But there is a disease that, you know, we people create.
The separation.
There's a disease. And that's this disease that, you know, we are creating within ourselves is a disease that, you know, it also separates the spirit of a human being. So I try to see the connection between that, you know, and
break down those separations. And break down,
try to mold them and to make it accessible to everybody who's ever is watching. Everybody. And
you know, I remember back in the late 80s and early 90s, this would have been about the time that you started professional dancing, that the arts at that time in South Africa were seen as about the only place where you could have whites and blacks together on stage, in theater, or in dance.
Yes.
And this came long before the first democratic election. Almost like the space that arts created for itself helped heal that country. Where are you now with a country that is supposed to be past that time of apartheid? Mm-hmm. Does the arts still have a role in making sure that the country has some kind of, you know, sensible or useful direction?
Well, you know, it's funny enough, because at the moment South Africa is now, I don't know, they say they're trying to find their identity, which is very strange, because we do have an identity. The uniqueness of, you know, the arts and the culture of South African people, we do have, but then they're trying to find it through the European way of doing things. And I see a lot of, at least nowadays, I see a lot of, especially the younger generation, them moving away, totally removing themselves within their cultural values and within their cultural aesthetic, away from that and trying to get more into the European system of doing things, which is not wrong. Everybody's got a right to be, you know, free to say whatever and do whatever they want. But then there is another way of doing things that, you know, is how you preserve that culture and how you can mold it so that, you know, the roots of it stays within that. But then, you know, there is a lot of freedomness into it as well, you know, how you bring all these different elements into that way. And talking about the government trying to make sure that, you know, these kind of things can be maintained, it's a very, very a thin line, you know, because they are much more now into, of course, the development of the country and the society and so on and so forth. And there is a lot of cut of the economy for the arts, the corruption of the, you know, the people in the government. And this nowadays, a lot of people, you know, they are much more interested in talking about, they're going back into the history of apartheid, saying that, oh, now, you know, we have a black government, things are worse. Which is true. You know, things are worse.
Well, not everything wasn't going to be solved.
Exactly. You know. So, you know, the people are really trying to find a way to say that this is who I am. And for me, you know, what I'm happy about in my work is that, you know, I truly know, people know that, you know, this is what I stand for. I don't change things within, like, you know, space of time. I maintain it. I make it stronger within, you know, the period of time over the years.
So tell me, if you are dancing in your hometown of Soweto, or if you're dancing somewhere in South Africa, or maybe somewhere in the United States or Europe, do you get the kind of feedback where you know you're making a difference, where someone says, thank you for that? I mean, can you think of a case either in Africa or somewhere else where that happened?
Oh, a lot.
Give me an example.
Lot. I mean, in South Africa, you know, I have, even the younger generation, because now my work is part of the educational system, the curriculum. They've asked to videotape my work, to document it, to take it to the school curriculum.
Careful, you'll be an ambassador sometime soon. You have to wear a suit all the time.
So, you know, it's for them, it's because it was very important to be able to understand, you know, for the younger generation to be able to maintain that. But then obviously, you know, there is a very, very strong support and understanding that, you know, why I'm doing this. And I'm getting lots of emails, you know, from people I don't even know, saying that, you know, oh, thank you very much. You know, we are so pleased to have someone like you. Please maintain that. And one of the biggest choreographers and mentor from Senegal, Germaine Agogny, she saw Menjaro and she said, this is exactly what we need. Exactly this, what you just did today, is exactly what we need for Africa. Not for South Africa, but for Africa. Because people, they've got other ideas.
Is this because you have dancers from Europe and Japan and yourself and this mix of African music? What was she zeroing in on?
I think she was, you know, pointing the fact that, you know, because of this mix of people and then within the authenticness of what I was doing and maintaining the belief of who we are.
That you can have that mix but not lose,
you know,
the roots
of what I was doing. But most importantly was to really, you know, show, you know, the younger generation that, you know, it is not a sin to do who you are. You know, it's a gift. It's a gift that, you know, you have to cherish it and then educate people about it and then give them, you can still maintaining it, but then make it much more organic, much more accessible to everybody. And she was really very happy. Even today, she, you know, she emails me saying, when are you coming to my company? When are you coming to my company? And I go to Japan, and the first time when I went to Japan, I've been going to Japan now for 7 years. The first time when I went to Japan, I went to teach, and I performed one of my solos. And I've never seen Japanese crying in a theater in my life, but they were crying. They were like in tears. And then after, the director of the theater said, do you know why they cried? I said, tell me, I don't know why they cried. And he said, well, it's because, you know, they feel that, you know, what they were doing, it gave them some kind of a light of who they are and then to be much more grounded on their roots. And I thought that, you know, they were very strong in their tradition, Japanese, which they are, but then obviously there was things that, you know, they were getting away from. And to see something that is, you know, is true to the point and is something that, you know, people can really feel. And it's not like, you know, okay, I can kick my leg 280 degrees and then thank you very much, clap for me. For me, it doesn't work like that. It's something that you have to be able to transport someone. You have to be able to make sure that, you know, people should remember. People should remember, you know, you, what you did that particular day. And people still remember my first solo I did. It's called Gula, the bird. I did in 1992. Even today, they say...
People still talk about it.
They still talk about it. The same solo. And I say, when are you doing that solo again? And I did it last year for the anniversary in South Africa. And I said, it doesn't change. Still the same. Still strong. Still beautiful. And, you know, it's this kind of thing that, you know, you want to give people some kind of, like, they have to have a chip of a memory that will stay forever in their, in, you know... And it's very important for that, you know, and it's very, very important.
Vincent Mantwe is an award-winning South African choreographer. He talked with me about his piece called Menjaro. Music for the performance was composed by Anthony Kaplan. Now, since we spoke, Vincent has had another world premiere of one of his works. He did it in conjunction with the folks at Dance Umbrella, and he's working on two new compositions. If you'd like to read more about Vincent and see some pictures, that's all on our website at thestory.org. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. You know about the feature on our program we call Your Story, a time for you to tell me about a time in your life when you learned something important, one of those experiences that changes you. Pam Rock was a Peace Corps volunteer in Guatemala. She'd had high hopes, but they'd been crushed by the reality of living in a place where she didn't speak the language and the existential crisis of wondering whether anyone even cared that she was there. She wrote these long letters home about her unhappiness and about the time she found help, well, from a rather surprising source.
Handbook for Volunteers, a few minor adjustments.
Not the sort of thing that you would expect to solve your problem. I mean, had you read this book? Had you studied it?
No, I hadn't. I think I had picked it up merely on a whim. I didn't have anything to do that night. I don't think I was at a place where I was so down in the dumps that I thought, well, maybe I ought to read the handbook. It was just...
Or I've read everything else in English that I have to read.
Right, right.
What's the passage that made a difference to you?
It's kind of long. I'm going to read what I wrote in the letter because it summed it up in the
sort
letter.
Sort of distills it. That's
right,
fine.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's do that.
So read me what you wrote to friends.
Okay. It says, I have been learning several lessons about expectations. When faced with new situations, we create expectations of what we think might happen in order to manage the nervous feelings we have regarding the unknown. But as we actually arrive in the new situation, we must be able to separate what we thought would happen to what actually is going on. If we don't, we can get disappointed, not necessarily because we don't like what's happening, but simply because it's different than what we expected. When this happens, our next move must be to suppress any disappointment that we have felt and see if the new situation can still be fulfilling and satisfying to us.
When you open this handbook, the word that catches your eye is expectations. This is like the key that unlocks it. What is it about expectations that gave you a different perspective on your time or your place in Guatemala?
It has to do with if you change your expectation, therefore you must be lowering it. And what this showed me was that by changing my expectation, I wasn't necessarily lowering it or raising it. I was merely changing it. It's not a good or a bad. It's just something that happens.
It's adapting rather than going up or going down, right?
Right.
In what way did you change your expectation in Guatemala? I mean, can you think back and look at what was different about Pam Rock the next day she stepped out of her room?
The next day, Pam wasn't worried about what I was doing, how I looked. I was okay with just being who I was and accepting the fact that I couldn't speak the language and that that they accepted me for who I was.
There's a fun kind of coda to this whole thing, and that is that while you were in Guatemala, you were very good, as you said, about communicating. You wrote out a letter, made copies, sent it to friends all over the States. But and that was, what, more than 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, you found that this little note that you wrote people, this letter you wrote about understanding expectations actually stuck with a bunch of people that you sent it to, right? It ended up being one of those little, I don't know, Ann Landers lessons that they kept with them in a desk drawer.
I got many comment letters back saying that that was very powerful to them. It makes me see how important sharing those issues that are very vital to us, that change our lives, because there's someone out there that needs to hear the same thing. And you know, I had to be willing to spell it out.
That's Pam Rock with her story, If You Have One, a story that's made a difference in your life or in the lives of others. I'd like to hear from you. You can get in touch with me by going to our website at thestory.org. Our program is produced by Corey Princell, Denise Schreiner, and Anita Woodley. Rachel McCarthy sitting in on one of the producer desks this week. Our researcher is Jeanette Arrowood. Jen Nathan has been doing our audio editing. Al Wadarski and Peter Bombar are our engineers. The story's managing editor and director is Carol Jackson. The senior producer of the program is Greg Kelly. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.